You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of November 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck, and Barrett Austin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the BBC is tearing itself apart over reporting failures. We look at how to fix the corporation.
And as Margin Call, the critically acclaimed film about the world of finance, launches on DVD today, we ask its director, J.C. Chandor, whether it's still an accurate reflection of the world of money.
Whether we're going to give the current administration another 4 years to try and progress the country forward and kind of away from this profit at all costs sort of perspective.
Angela Merkel visits Lisbon today, and the Eurozone finance ministers are talking Greece. So we'll be getting the latest on the mood in Europe's austerity capitals, Lisbon, Athens, and Madrid.
We have to remind ourselves that the official figures don't reflect the reality on the ground. A lot of people work cash and hand jobs, and this 26% figure, if it was actually true, the whole country actually wouldn't work.
And we also speak to our New York bureau chief to hear what's making the lunchtime news there.
All this and much more coming up during the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Bill Bingham. The head of news at the British Broadcasting Corporation has stepped aside after a TV news programme falsely accused a former senior politician of child abuse. The BBC has been rocked by two programmes, one making the false accusation broadcast last week, and another which alleged child sex abuse by a former star presenter, the late Jimmy Savile, but which was not aired. Helen Bowden, director of BBC News, and her deputy Stephen Mitchell have stepped aside pending a review of why editors spiked the report last year on Savile, who's been accused of abusing children on BBC premises. The row has sparked one of the worst crises in the publicly funded broadcaster's 90-year history. These BBC viewers say it's worrying.
Well, we always used to rely on the BBC for being factual. If you wanted to watch a news programme, you automatically switched to the BBC because you knew that they'd get it right. But now, you know, you wonder, are they sort of biased one way or another? So
I think it's a lot of fuss about nothing, and I think George Entwistle has been really badly treated, and I think we should value the BBC. It's a fantastic institution.
I wouldn't say that my kind of confidence in it has been rocked hugely.
George Entwistle, the BBC's Director General, resigned over the controversy last week. MPs have criticised Mr Entwistle's payoff deal. He was only in the job for 54 days, but the BBC Trust says he'll be paid a full year's salary of £450,000, as well as his pension earnings of £87,000. The chairman of Britain's Parliamentary Select Committee on Media, Culture and Sport says the payment is unjustifiable and unacceptable. NATO says it will defend its alliance member Turkey, which struck back after mortar rounds fired from Syria landed inside its border. Turkey is becoming increasingly concerned about security along its border with Syria, in an area of the southeast where Ankara is also fighting a Kurdish insurgency. Meanwhile, Turkey says it needs help providing winter shelter and food to tens of thousands of Syrians seeking refuge from a prolonged civil war. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is making an emergency appeal for 32 million Swiss francs. That's around $34 million. Simon Eccleshall, the head of crisis management with the Federation, described what they need the money for.
To support the Turkish Red Crescent in providing predominantly winter assistance to 100,000 people who are presently living in the camps in southern Turkey. There's also some provision of emergency food and non-food assistance to 20,000 people who are currently congregating at the Turkish-Syria border, as well as providing contingency stocks for an additional 50,000 people, both food and non-food items.
Six Gulf states have recognized the Syrian opposition coalition as the country's legitimate representative. The National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces was unveiled in Doha on Sunday, aimed at uniting the factions who want to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad. The coalition's president will be Moaz al-Khatib, a former Damascus imam who fled Syria this year. Eurozone finance ministers have been meeting in Brussels to discuss whether to release new funds to Greece. The Greek government believes it's done all it can to win the next instalment of bailout money after passing a 2013 budget, which will mean large spending cuts. The parents of Austin Tice, a US journalist believed to be in captivity in Syria, have made an appeal for the release of their son. The 31-year-old freelance journalist, whose work has appeared in the Washington Post, disappeared in Syria in August. In October, the US State Department said it believed he was alive and being held by the Syrian government. Mark and Deborah Tice have travelled to Beirut to work on securing the return of their son.
Is he well? How can we contact him? And how can we return him to our family? If anyone who hears this has any information about Austin, and especially what we can do to bring him home, please contact us.
The European Union has agreed to suspend its rules requiring airlines flying to and from airports in the EU to pay for their carbon emissions. The rules have been unpopular with countries outside Europe, such as the US, China and India. Climate Commissioner Connie Hedegaard says she's stopping the clock for 1 year because progress is being made on a global emissions deal. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. It's 18.06 here in London, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And we're going to be looking at that BBC saga in a little bit more depth next. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
No media organization feels comfortable when it becomes the story, especially when it's supposed to be a national institution. This weekend, the BBC was mainly reporting on itself as two disastrous stories on pedophilia by its flagship program Newsnight continue to wreak havoc. The first one seems to have been a good story somehow buried. The second a story that did run, which should have never passed go.
But how does this stop? What can the BBC do to save its reputation? To discuss this even, we're joined by Professor John Owen at City University in London and Tyler Brulet, Monocle's editor-in-chief. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. First of all, John, can we just clear up one tiny thing before we start a very complicated debate? The reputation of City University has also been somehow attached at the back end to this story, hasn't it? The Department for Investigative Journalism, which I know sits slightly within City University, was one of the instigators of the story, which now seems to have been not true. Is there some concern at City University that this is going to kind of wash back to you as well?
Well, the Bureau, run by Ian Overton, has had a very laudable record for breaking investigative stories. I had him speak to my class 3 weeks ago. So this is a real bombshell for him to have to resign, and the credibility of the Bureau on the line right now. It's a not-for-profit investigative project like ProPublica in the United States, and its credibility has been damaged by this. Yeah, they've got a real crisis over there as well.
And do you think, John, that what we're seeing here, before we look at the more solution-driven side of it, do you think, John, what we're seeing here is a failure of management or a failure of journalism within the BBC?
Both, because great journalism requires great journalism managers. I mean, I doubt if I would like to think that the editor-in-chief sitting next to me of Monocle would sign off on probably every word in this publication. I think the obvious problem is that you've had a structure where you've had a director general responsible for Strictly Come Dancing and the license fee, as well as being expected to sign off on what was in every program, or at least be aware in an accountable chain of command. That has obviously collapsed and will have to be fixed. Rupert Murdoch's even tweeting that. The Daily Telegraph is arguing that in an editorial. I think that is certainly one of the things that's going to come out of this.
Tyler, can I ask you, you worked for the BBC in your very early career. You've seen an organisation that you've been with inside and watched from outside grow and develop. Do you think they're having trouble coping with a kind of a new media landscape where they're trying to be commercial and also a state broadcaster when they're going across the internet? They don't know whether they should be tweeting. There's all so much content going on. As John was saying, it's very hard for somebody to be both running this as a corporation and being the editor-in-chief.
Well, I think one of the interesting things, watching many programmes this morning, but particularly a lot of the BBC navel-gazing this morning, now whether you thought that they should be covering this for 15 minutes at the top or actually devoting sort of a full 2 hours to it is debatable. But that aside, I think that one of the key topics that has come up is... People are referencing this charter, and the problem is that the charter is now woefully out of date. Everyone talks about what the job description is for the Director General, but this is a changed world, and I think in many ways they should almost look to something of a print model, where of course in our structure we have a CEO who happens to be editor in chief. That would be me, but we also have you, Andrew, as the editor of the magazine. We also have Pam, who is the publisher. And I think that's the critical issue here. At a time when the BBC knows they have to go far beyond the license fee to actually make this thing tick over and work. And of course, you see BBC Worldwide being a very commercial operation, and ultimately something which, of course, trickles up to the Director General, it's very, very difficult to go and sign off on every single news program and look at, potentially any contentious area of content, and then also be expected to be out at every major global trade fair hawking your programs, etc. So I think, as we've seen a lot of news organizations calling for some type of separation, I think there's a very, very simple model that many a media organization follows, and as highlighted, there needs to be a division between what is publishing and commercial and what is editorial. John, I'm not sure what...
But the old editor in me, and I'm sure you, and in the old editor and so many people who are looking at this, cannot quite accept that even though Entwistle couldn't be expected to be across everything, that he wouldn't have wanted to know what is going to be in this program. Why didn't my public affairs department tell me about this tweet by Ian Overton? It raises questions. Are we naming this guy? And not see the program that night? Humphreys obviously eviscerated him in that Saturday interview. But I think that absence of curiosity, even for a position where the guy is across so many other things, it still, I think, just... it blows your mind.
Barrett, can I ask you a side question? Watching this from New York, it play out there. In fact, a former BBC Director General has gone to run a big chunk of the New York Times, who I believe he starts work today. How has this story played out in the States?
I think it's something of a difficult comparison to sort of bring up. But if you look, the New York Times itself is no stranger to this sort of controversy. Just in the past decade, you've had a couple of high-profile incidents, first in 2003 with Jason Blair and then a few years later with Judith Miller, where similar things came up. Ultimately, they were, essentially forced into resignation for some period of time. The paper was weakened, but by all means, the New York Times has come out quite strong.
Do you think that's true, Tyler? That's a good example that, that at the moment there is a frenzy around this story, but that the BBC's its central role and the quality of the majority of its journalism will save it? Or do you think that actually is a bit unlike the New York Times in the sense it is so big and unwieldy that it really needs a bit more roots and branch work on it before it can turn itself around?
Well, I think on the root and branch side, I think part of it is figuring out how you're going to nourish this thing. And it might be sort of the knee-jerk reaction to say parachute somebody inside to actually figure this out. But when you look at someone like George Entwistle, he'd been there for 23 years. It's great to be a career diplomat and be there day in and day out. But I think what you see in all of this is that sadly, there's very little intake at the top of new talent, and you see that this is something, a beast which really performs like a public service player. It's like the military. You just sort of make your way up the ranks if you keep your head down enough. And I think that's a huge problem. And I thought it was a big issue. I've worked with George Entwistle before. I used to think maybe in very early days, people were asking me, you know, what did you think about the appointment? I said, good editorial judgment. Oops. But I said, you know, would be probably challenged in the role of being a really good commercial head. You know, sadly, it hasn't worked out either way. But I think, you know, one thing they do need to work on is actually bringing in some fresh talent. And as this company sort of reaches out around the world, you sort of have a bit of a question mark that is it a bit too much of a still a very British operation, doesn't behave like an international company.
John, if you were sitting there today within the BBC and that you'd been called on to give your view, what would you suggest were the one or two things that they need to do over the next week, month, year to kind of turn around this organization?
Well, I think the thing we talked about earlier, I think, is an obvious first solution. Let's separate the positions and let's get an inspired, commanding, respected, rigorous editorial director-in-chief to really boost morale. And because the danger now is that the BBC journalism is going to start sitting back. They're not going to pursue stories. What is the point in pursuing investigative reports if it's going to get you in hot water? They need someone to step in and say, we are going to be a bold journalistic organization the way we've always been. I think that is the first thing that has to happen, and they have to find somebody who's willing to play that role and be on the floor. I was at the Daily Telegraph earlier in this week, and I was watching this in this massive newsroom. There was the senior editor-in-chief, Tony Gallagher. He was on the floor at the major meeting right in the center of this massive newsroom. And someone who used to be a student of mine, works there, said, you know, he's there for every major meeting asking, where did we get this information? What are our sources? It requires that kind of hands-on editorial leadership, especially for the next little while. They're going to have to be there all the time.
And Tyler, can I finally ask you in a kind of a solution-driven sense, what would you do today if you had to kind of begin to nudge this organization back? We've talked about bringing someone from inside. Do you think that should be someone from another media organization? Do you think you'd even look overseas to hire someone?
I don't think one has to necessarily jump across the Atlantic and bring in a news czar, because, of course, we know that government always loves, you know, a czar, particularly in this country. I don't think it's that. They've looked around at some of the programs, of course. You know, we've seen some appointments today. And I think we have to sort of figure out whether those make sense. But, you know, as John is saying, they have to lead from the front right now. And you can see right now just an editorial crisis, just the amount they're talking about their own story. You can see that it is absolutely rudderless right now. There's absolutely no sense of perspective. So I would make sure right now that they have a very, very good editor in place to, A, restore morale, not just on the part of the editorial floor, but also for viewers as well.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both for coming in to talk to us about the terrible debacle that's been unfolding at the BBC. That was Professor John Owen of City University, and he's not in charge of the whole place, and Tyler Brûlé, Monocle's editor-in-chief, who is in charge of the whole place. Anyway, next we're going to hear whether J.C. Chander, who's the director of the film Margin Call, thinks that lessons have finally been learnt since the crash of 2008.
Wherever you're going this winter, and whether for work or for play, let Monocle editors be your travel companions. We've published our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts. You can have our 25-25 guide series in your hand with the Monocle 24 app, available from iTunes. Or download free guides from monocle.com. Looking for a cozy bar in Zurich or a good pair of gloves in Moscow? We can help. From São Paulo to New York, Shanghai to Dubai, Monocle can guide you to the best place to sign that deal over lunch or help find a crackling fire to sit by for the night.
London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, New York, and Toronto. On October the 19th, Monocle opened the doors to its newest shop. Chock full of our regular goodies from Porter bags, Ettinger leather goods, 2013 Diaries by Marx, and Hakkisan ceramic wine cups. Check out all of our collaboration products or flip through the latest issues of the magazine. Find the perfect gifts for Christmas or just a treat for yourself. Visit us on College Street in Toronto or at our other shops around the world. And remember, you can sign up to our weekly bulletin at monocle.com to find out about all of the newest products as they hit the shelves.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and Barrett Austin. J.C. Chander's critically acclaimed 2011 film Margin Call managed to give an idea of what happens in an investment firm when all begins to go horribly wrong.
And with the film launching on DVD today, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke to director J.C. Chandor to discuss the lessons the financial industry has learned from the financial crisis. First, Chandor explained what drew him to work with this topic.
I had never written anything sort of even remotely as topical as this. It sort of was something, frankly, that I had shied away from in throughout my sort of writing career. But it was a situation where, you know, all the stars kind of aligned, and frankly, it was something that I couldn't really ignore any longer. My father had worked in that business for, you know, 35 or 40 years throughout my whole life. I had grown up in a community with a lot of bankers in suburban New York and in suburban London. And then I had moved to New York City for most of my adult life. And so a lot of my friends over that kind of 10-year period had been brought into the business. And so I had watched them, you know, really from all different levels kind of get brought in, some get spit out, a lot of different things. And so it was one of these things by the fall of 2008, I kind of realized that it probably was something that I would have an interesting take on. And then I kind of came up with the kind of hook, which was these kind of characters trapping them, you know, on this floor, sort of on an overnight experience, which is something that I felt was a way of taking kind of the inherent weakness of a movie about the financial crash, which is kind of its lack of cinematic characteristics, and kind of turned it on its head. And you sort of used what was its weakness, which is the fact that not a lot goes on. A lot of it in this day and age especially is done over computers and phones and almost silently, you know, that these billions of dollars and people's lives are being made or ruined, you know, really virtually and with so little kind of human interaction, or seemingly so little human interaction. So short answer to your question is, it, with all the elements in my life that kind of came together, it became sort of unavoidable that it was something that I felt that I should probably weigh in on.
It's very theatrical in a way, in that you are, you know, the vast majority of the film takes place pretty much on one floor in this office block, and there's no real interaction with the outside world. And you even get that sense as well when one of the characters talks about, you know, we're looking at other people, ordinary people, living their lives. Did you think that was important to sort of show them, even at the time of crisis, in this sort of bubble with no real connection to the real world?
Yeah, the neat thing is, I mean, the first notes you ever get from like an investor is, oh, I want to see, you know, how this affects the outside world. And, you know, and the way I sort of looked at it is like, everyone knew how it affected them. You know, when you go out to see a movie, you kind of, you're pretty sure you've seen the result and the effect that it's had on your life. But with this film, what I found was sort of interesting is, you know, at this point, when this crisis is sort of looming on the horizon, the fact was, people within that industry, the reason we kind of partially got into this mess is because none of those people were thinking, you know, about how it would affect anyone else. It was really about their lives, and especially as the crisis, the vice tightened on them, you know, it was all about self-preservation.
One of the interesting things you touch upon in the film is about how a lot of very, very clever people are drawn into this world when they could be doing other things. You have, you know, a main character who is a genuine rocket scientist. You've got someone else who's an analyst who used to be an engineer who built bridges. Do you, you know, when we look at, you know, what's happened in the fallout from the crash, is that one potential silver lining that you hope for, that maybe some of these real-life rocket scientists and bridge builders will stick to that rather than go for a career in finance?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the most, I think, obvious kind of social message in the film, if there is one, you know, is that these are, you know, skill sets that, in my sort of humble opinion, were being misused. And the education system, as it is even more so in England, but here, you know, it's entirely tax-free. You know, the reason that they're put there and the reason that we don't tax them is because they're supposed to be delivering educated people into the workforce, you know, to actually move society forward. And in a very, over the last 15 years, through very skilled, you know, gift-giving and then kind of just, it's almost exactly what happened to our regulation, but in the U.S., just the line slowly and slowly was blurred on the recruitment side at the finest universities. I mean, these are our best and brightest that we're working in this world, that we're being sucked into this world. And, you know, the money was certainly a big, big part of it. I'm not going to say that that isn't, but it also became sort of acceptable for all these banks to literally go into Harvard University and recruit right there, you know, in the university and set up, you know, shop essentially. And so it became very, the universities became very complicit in sort of as almost like a feeder program, you know, into these banks, which is not the way that it was structured to be using, you know, to be bringing these people right into such a, you know, a profit-centric, profit-centric sort of business.
And just finally, I just want to ask you about the way that the arts deals with major political crises. If we look at, you know, the last major proper crisis in the US, you could argue it was, you know, the Vietnam War. And it wasn't until about a decade or so later when I think, you know, when Platoon came out that you saw any sort of proper sort of reaction and sort of looking back at what happened. And then obviously there were many other films as well. This time around, there's been more. There's been Your Own. There's been Inside Job as a documentary that's done a pretty decent job of highlighting what happened. Do you think that we'll see more as a sort of as the years go on, a sort of more nuanced view of what the crash did to America, or do you think people are going to tire of it quite quickly?
I would think you'd now sort of see it die off for a little bit, and then hopefully from a more historical, as you said, nuanced perspective, you'd start to see the results. And whether we go, I think this election was very telling, frankly, of whether we were going to go right back and kind of forget the mistakes that we had made, or whether we're going to give the current administration another 4 years to try and progress the country, you know, forward and kind of away from this profit at all costs sort of perspective.
That was J.C. Chandor, director of Margin Call, speaking to Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to Midori House.
Now, before the news, we've got a good song for anyone who works in the world of finance. It's Opportunities from the Pet Shop Boys and Let's Make Lots of Money.
And that was the Pet Shop Boys with Opportunities. In the next half hour of the program, we'll get the latest from Lisbon as German Chancellor Angela Merkel visits the city. We'll also have lunch with our New York Bureau Chief Aisha Spears.
But first, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
The head of news at the British Broadcasting Corporation has stepped aside after a TV news program falsely accused a former senior politician of child abuse. Helen Bowden, director of BBC News, and her deputy, Stephen Mitchell, have stepped aside pending a review of the controversy. The row has sparked one of the worst crises in the publicly funded broadcaster's 90-year history. The BBC's Director General George Entwistle resigned over the row last week. MPs have criticised Mr Entwistle's payoff deal. He was only in the job for 54 days, but the BBC's trust says he'll be paid a full year's salary of £450,000, as well as his pension earnings. NATO says it will defend its alliance member Turkey, which struck back after mortar rounds fired from Syria landed inside its border. Turkey is becoming increasingly concerned about security along its border with Syria in an area of the southeast where Ankara is also fighting a Kurdish insurgency. Turkey says it needs help providing winter shelter and food to tens of thousands of Syrians seeking refuge from a prolonged civil war. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is making an emergency appeal for 32 million Swiss francs. Six Gulf states have recognised the Syrian Opposition Coalition as the country's legitimate representative. The National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces was unveiled in Doha on Sunday. Eurozone finance ministers have been meeting in Brussels to discuss whether to release new funds to Greece. The Greek government believes it's done all it can to win the next instalment of bailout money after passing a 2013 budget, which will mean large spending cuts. The European Union has agreed to suspend its rules requiring airlines flying to and from airports in the EU to pay for their carbon emissions. Climate Commissioner Connie Hedegaard says she's stopping the clock for 1 year because progress is being made on a global emissions deal. And those are the latest Monocle 24 headlines.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London. With German Chancellor Angela Merkel braving protesters in cash-strapped Lisbon and Eurozone finance ministers meeting this afternoon in Brussels to talk Greece, financial woes continue to blight the landscape across much of Western Europe. To take a step beyond the dizzying facts and figures surrounding Europe's debt challenges and unabated unemployment figures, we're heading south to Madrid, Lisbon, and Athens for a look at the impact of the financial crisis.
And we're going to start in Spain, where a little bit earlier, Barrett was speaking with Liam Aldous. He's our Monocle Madrid correspondent. The headlines have been dominated there with the news that the government is going to prevent people who have not paid their mortgages from being evicted from their homes, at least for the next 24 months.
Since 2008, there's been between, I mean, the figures differ, but it's been between 350,000 and 400,000 families evicted from homes, and it's mainly due to the huge burst of the housing bubble here. So it's been a big issue. Particularly, you've seen protesters go into banks recently, and it's really stepped up the pressure on the government. You've seen, like in Barcelona as well as in Madrid, people going to banks and picketing the banks and pressuring them to stop these evictions, because there's been two high profile cases of suicides, actually, sadly, when police were about to go in and evict the tenants. They've actually thrown themselves out of the window. So this has actually increased a lot of pressure on the government, and you've seen today the two sides of politics come together to work together for a solution. So this is one positive to come out of it. Finally, there's been some common sense in the halls of power, and they've put a freeze on these evictions, because it's actually become a symbolic issue of the crisis itself.
And it seems the issue of eviction, it sort of escapes the eviction issues that you're having in places like the U.S. The New York Times yesterday published a piece essentially putting out a very depressing tale of a number of families that have been pushed out of their homes and are essentially living in buildings without electricity, and in many cases succumbing to outright homelessness. How dire is that situation on the ground?
Well, it is quite dire, and I think the media is playing a role here, because they're really putting a human face on the issue, which is important, because we're obviously hearing a lot about cuts to services and the government's not having money, and you're seeing a lot of the politicians giving their typical speeches. But when you see these people getting evicted, it really does actually hit a raw nerve with a lot of the people. And I've seen other protest groups try to block the police enter into these residences, and we also saw the police union chief yesterday say that he would actually back up any police who refused to take part in these evictions. So obviously a lot of people are finding it tough, and yeah, it is quite a big issue.
And to speak a bit more about the issue of protest across society in Spain, you know, we've seen the subtle rise of opposition groups in places like Greece. In Greece, you've got the far-right Golden Front. Do you find any sort of opposition groups forming in Spain in response to sustained austerity measures?
Well, we're not seeing the rise of the far-right in Spain yet. That's not really an issue. But there are obviously the Indignado movement, which started here in Spain and actually was the precursor to the Occupy Wall Street movement, has kept going, but they're kind of made up of disparate groups, so they haven't really organized themselves, and they have a policy of not really talking to the media very much. They don't trust the media here, so they don't really have a very consistent message. So the government finds it very easy just to kind of dismiss what they're saying. So there are opposition groups, and we're actually going to see this issue rear its head again on Wednesday. There's a general strike in Spain. So obviously the protesters will once again take center stage, and they've actually planned on surrounding the Congress, which is their new tactic of surrounding the Congress again, but they've vowed to stay on through the night. Usually they stay on until about 1 or 2 and the police kind of move them on, but they've actually vowed to stay. So we're going to see another confrontation, I think.
I want to ask one final question. If you look at reports, unemployment is still, you know, around 26%. What's the feeling on the grounds? Is there any sense of optimism, especially on the part of Spain's young?
Well, it depends where you go. Obviously, in the big cities, in Madrid, for example, the situation's a little bit better, and in Barcelona as well. But a lot of young people are obviously looking to go abroad and look for work. I know a lot of young people, actually, who have lost their jobs recently and are looking for jobs every day and can't really find anything. And obviously, the hopelessness will kick in. But we have to remind ourselves that the official figures actually don't reflect the reality on the ground. A lot of people work cash-in-hand jobs, and this 26% figure, if it was actually true, the whole city would, the whole country actually wouldn't work. So there's a lot of people. It's very Spanish, actually, to work. Work and cash in hand jobs and not actually tell the government. So it would be interesting to see what the real unemployment figure was.
And just in case the government is listening, and we don't pay him cash in hand. That was Liam Aldous, who's Monocle's Madrid correspondent. He was just talking to Barrett early on today. Now we're going to Lisbon next, where Saima Tariq is joining us on the line. Just tell us a little bit about what's going on in Lisbon. The first thing is, what's so strange is when you see in the news, the Portuguese seem to have taken their austerity measures without getting kind of too wound up and angered. We don't see the same kind of demonstrations on the street that we're seeing in Athens or even across the border in Spain. Why is that?
That's been true more or less until around 2 months ago. I mean, protest is still pretty on a small scale. We saw outside the presidential palace today when Merkel arrived, there were a few hundred people, but I mean, it really started changing in September with this new movement. They are currently progressing in violence and in increased police presence. There have been a few injuries, no deaths. I would say that it's quite slow going, and I guess the situation is not as bad as in Spain or Greece. As Liam was saying, there aren't widespread evictions. I mean, living standards have significantly decreased, obviously, but the anger these days is kind of addressed on a pragmatic basis. So, for example, the German Chancellor visiting, or the new 2013 budget measures being announced. So,
Simon, just give me a little bit of kind of your personal take when you're on the streets of Lisbon. What evidence is there that this austerity is kind of taking its toll? Is it empty shop fronts? Do you notice that people are going out less? How would you gauge the mood of the city?
Well, I'd say there are definitely less people on the streets, and Lisbon for sure feels very empty at times because a lot of young people are leaving. And a lot of Portuguese graduates are going to former colonies such as Mozambique and Angola, which means an already kind of empty downtown. There are more and more bricked up buildings. There are less and less new shops opening. There are all these closing down sales everywhere. I mean, there are a few sectors that are still surviving, like luxury retail, but that's mainly, again, thanks to Angolan investment, Angolan consumption. So, yes, you can definitely see a kind of darkening mood, and that's kind of matched with the end of the summer here. More people are staying indoors. Restaurants are struggling somewhat. But I think the 2013 budget with the really increased tax rises will really compound that problem.
Well, Saima, thank you very much indeed for joining us from Lisbon.
And next we speak to our old friend Yasson Zakonis, Athens-based entrepreneur. Hello, how are you?
Hello, good evening.
It seems that we can't go more than a couple of weeks without hearing Greece's international lenders debating an effective means of reducing deficits and decreasing joblessness. I want to ask you, what's the mood like in Athens right now?
The mood is like in a way in between two storms. But so we had like the measures, the new austerity measures that were voted for on Wednesday, and we had the new budget that was voted for yesterday. In a way, there is all this talk now that we don't know when we're going to get the next, let's say, installment. So there's a wait-and-see situation on the one hand, but again, there is I think everybody is looking for the next, the vision, the new vision for Greece. And this is a big question mark still.
In talking a little bit more about the new vision for Greece, you sort of serve as an entrepreneur. I want to talk about opportunity in Greece. Obviously, cash is very tight in the country right now, but for those who do have access to money, what sort of investment and innovation are you seeing in Greece right now?
I think there are like two, three sectors, let's say. One is there's a technology sector, and there's a big direction that goes towards mobile phone applications, and these are companies that can fare quite well internationally. There's another sector where you see a number of creative people that either try to start up their own shop or they're working for their family business and they want to make reposition their products to become more extrovert, better quality, better pricing. And then you have the tourism sector, where, you know, you always have the you know, some of the best beaches globally, the best weather, and again, there is a process to redefine the product and the brand. Of course, I'm leaving the shipping outside, because shipping is now does not have to do much with what's going on in the local economy, although it's like a big sector, positive sector for the country. But the first three sectors, there's definitely movement, and definitely people are looking into ways to reposition themselves within a new vision.
Well, Yason, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Yason Zakanas in Athens, and that's the end of our roundup of the austerity capitals of Europe. You're listening to Midori House, and we're going to be right back after this to find out why school chairs are causing outrage in London.
The power of photography was pulled into focus at this year's Pre-Pic Day, the world's leading prize for photography in the realm of sustainability.
These are true artists, and they have incredible integrity. I mean, they tell you how it is. In the process, it's often disturbing. Sometimes it's beautiful in an abstract way, but it really touches a nerve.
Monocle Films attended the awards, and you can watch our film in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and also Barrett Austin, who's all the way here from New York, sitting in the studio here at Studio One. It's 18:44 here in London, which means it's 13:44 in Barrett's hometown back in New York City. Now, reports surfaced in the British press over the weekend that an alarmingly expensive school chair was adorning the Holland Park Comprehensive School in London, which reopens next week. The chair in question was designed by one of London's best designers, Russell Pinch, and manufactured by heritage British furniture brand Urquhart. It was reported that each chair cost £300, a lot to soak up in a time of austerity, especially when Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, has spoken widely of cost-cutting in school building and furnishing.
But beyond outrage at the cost, what the press failed to question was that perhaps this was a canny investment on part of the forward-thinking headmaster, one who understands the benefit of investing in furniture that might be built to last. Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, spoke to the chair's designer, Russell Pinch, earlier to dig a little deeper. He began asking if the chair really did cost £300.
They are £300 a chair bought at retail, and of course, costs are completely different to something of this scale where they're buying en masse, and I think it was over 2,000 chairs. There's economies of scale, and of course, everybody cut their prices to the bone to try and make sure that this project happened. They're made by Urquhart and designed by us, but they certainly don't cost anywhere near in the region of £300.
No, I thought that was probably the case. But a little bit more than sort of just the cost of the chairs, though, what struck us about this story is the fact that here is a fantastic historic school that has invested in yourself as a designer and Urquhart as a traditional heritage British manufacturer of furniture to outfit its school properly rather than just on minimum budget plastic chairs without any regard for how things might feel to sit on or be used, not just on a day-to-day basis, but over generations too.
It's been an extraordinary project is the only way to describe it. About 2 years ago, we were approached by the headmaster who asked us, would we be interested in designing a school chair? At the time, I had no idea of the scale of the project he was talking about, but it developed, and he was very keen that it was made in the UK and by a British designer. So we were invited to design this chair, which we did, and Urquhol, based in High Wycombe, made the chair. It's been a wonderful privilege to be able to be involved in a project where, one, you have the passion of the school that want to actually invest in design and invest in a quality piece of furniture made by Urquhol, and at the same time have the passion to see it all the way through and be so involved in the design process.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask, is they didn't just give you a brief and then let you get on with it and expect delivery of 300 chairs 2 years later.
That's actually.
A lot more than that. But you say that they were involved in the design process and the testing too, presumably?
Yes, the design process was quite a long period. We had many meetings with 1 to 5 scale models all the way through to 3 rounds of prototyping. Yes, they were involved at every stage. They obviously knew how these pieces were going to be used, and they had some very interesting observations. Things like plastic chairs that they've used in the past are very easily knocked over when children run through classrooms, and they wanted something that had a bit more weight to it so that it would actually stay in place a bit more, which was interesting. There was a real process to the whole thing, and it was collaborative.
It sounds very refreshing, because we also read a lot in the UK that Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, wants to cut cost at any and every expense, particularly in outfitting new schools with classroom furniture. It just seems ridiculous that there isn't more of an investment in the long term. We spent some time looking last year for our education issue at the way schools were furnished in Germany, Austria, Switzerland particularly, and they have a completely different approach, which is that you invest in well-made furniture and designing classrooms properly, and it not only increases children's ability to concentrate, but it means that you might be spending a little bit more money now, but you're investing in the future. You won't have to buy new plastic chairs in 5 years' time once they've all been knocked over 100 times.
I sincerely hope so. I mean, I have to say that it was an extraordinary time when this budget was signed off, and in extraordinary circumstances in which a lot of the capital for, I believe, the whole project was raised in land sales and all kinds of things. So it is extraordinary, but I really think that the interesting thing is, when I first visited Holland Park School, they were working out of around 50 porter cabins stacked up on a site where they demolished the school next to it. Now, even at that point, the school had managed to bring a sort of human and sensitive and really interesting environment to even the porter cabins. So they appreciated the fact that environment was obviously very important to them in how the children reacted to it and how they learned. For example, they'd put beautiful wooden shelves on the sides of the porter cabin with all the sort of finest pieces of literature, all the front covers of all these books in the English classroom. It was that sort of attention to detail that you knew that right from the beginning, that if they had the budget, which they did end up having, they would produce an extraordinary school, which they've done.
That was Russell Pinch, designer of the now infamous 300-pound Holland Park school chair, speaking to Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and Barrett Austin. Well, it's 22:49 now in Moscow, which means it's 18:49 here in London and 13:45 in New York. And that's where we're going to next to speak to our New York bureau chief, Aisha Spears.
Hello, Aisha. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you guys?
I'm doing well, doing well. Lucky to be here in London at the moment.
Yes, we've nabbed him from the New York bureau from you, Aisha.
I know, I'm sad and lonely over here. No, I'm joking.
I'm glad you got the phones up and running, and perhaps that's not a bad place to start. The fallout from Sandy continues. Just tell us, first of all, are most things back to normal within Manhattan at least? And what other consequences are you still seeing in the city?
Indeed. So for most people living in Manhattan, it's kind of hard to notice that 2 weeks ago this huge hurricane did hit. There are still some bridges and tunnels which aren't fully running. Some subway lines and some rail lines to Long Island and upstate and to New Jersey aren't running. But if you're just living your day in Manhattan, you can pretty much ignore that anything happened at all. But for about 125,000 people in New York City, there are still they don't have power. A lot of them don't have homes. There's still a huge relief effort underway, predominantly across Rockaway Beach and in Staten Island, which are the two kind of very badly hit areas. And so Governor Cuomo has asked for $30 billion from the federal government for disaster aid for the city region.
And Aisha, obviously as a fellow New Yorker myself, one of the questions that I have that I think a lot of people are asking is, as far as infrastructure goes, as far as power goes, when are people expecting things to sort of return to normal?
Well, the Long Island Power people have said that this is going to be happening over the next week, but there are some places where there aren't even homes to power. So I think for a lot of people, they just don't know. Part of the thing that Cuomo's asked for is a lot of the money will go to not only repair tunnels and bridges and homes that have been damaged, but also to develop better infrastructure. So there'll be a smart power grid. They'll modernize the fuel supply, which really I think has been one of the most shocking things that, Barrett, I know you've seen lines and lines for gas stations. How there can be a situation where New York City in the northeast of the U.S. can't get petrol is absurd. So that's something which Cuomo will look to fix too, as well as new oil and gas pipelines to provide things that if there was another storm, which there will be, those things won't be damaged.
And what's the state of the whole petrol dilemma at the moment? Are you still seeing four and five-hour lines?
Yeah, well, thankfully we're not. Well, I don't drive, so I'm personally not seeing them. I'm just going to stick by foot. But yes, I think if you go anywhere in New Jersey, certain parts of New Jersey and certain parts of Brooklyn, Queens, any cab driver you get into their car at the moment, they're saying that they're lining up for 3 or 4 hours. I think it's getting slightly better, but it's clearly not fixed yet. And it's an odd thing that people really didn't factor in. Those people with Toyota Priuses and all sorts of kind of hybrid cars are probably laughing as they're driving down the street with not needing as much gas as everyone else.
Now the kind of hand wringing and the fretting over what went wrong after the election for the Republican Party continues, and the Republicans are beginning to wonder what to do next. You've got a kind of a take on this from Newt Gingrich.
Indeed. So Newt Gingrich, who was obviously one of the Republican candidates, who's very outspoken, who did eventually endorse Mitt Romney, but who's an odd guy, the former Speaker of the House, has published a lot of books. He has written a piece on Politico, on the website Politico, called Stop Talking and Spend Some Time Thinking. And it starts with three words that just say, we were wrong, which is a pretty bold statement for the Republicans to take, for a leading Republican to take. He goes on to say that they don't understand the electorate, that they don't understand how things work. There's also a few people coming out of the Republican Party, like Karen Hughes, who's a former Bush advisor, saying that one of the reasons that her college-age daughter's friends didn't vote for the Republicans is because of the stuff that Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch said about rape and the rape caucus as they're being branded. So you've got a lot of senior Republicans having a rethink, and hopefully over the next 4 years, this will be a good option for the party to kind of, oh, sorry, opportunity for the party to work out how to attract younger voters, non-white voters, the people who they really missed out on in both 2008 and 2012.
Now, I'm sure you're a big Fox fan, but when you flick your remote to Fox, are you seeing any sense there that they understand that there was a demographic shift, that actually some people don't really care about whether gay people get married, you know, that there's something gone on in America that they can't deal with, in a sense, as the Republicans, because they are so wedded to that other half of America, which is this other thing, which we've seen this very divided country which could never deal with those things, no matter what happened.
Not yet. Sadly, Fox News is not leading the way in terms of bridging any sort of liberal and right-wing gap, and I'm not sure they will be the people to do it. There's been a lot of silly stuff said on that news channel before, during, and after the election, but I think that you'll see a lot of people already talking about, where are the Reagan Republicans? Where are the people that can bring people into the middle? Would Colin Powell step up? How would that work? Who's the young upstart Republican? Do we need someone who isn't white? Could Marco Rubio really fill the shoes? So everyone's already talking about who will be next and how that will excite the younger voter and the non-white voter. But no, Fox News is still not really a beacon of light for that argument yet.
And to take a step back from politics and look at issues of national security and intelligence, we've all been hearing a lot about General Petraeus and his scandal. Is this more than a scandal, or was there in fact a real security threat in play?
Well, this is what we don't know yet, and it's going to be, I mean, it's a boring, salacious scandal at its worst.
Hello. I think we've unfortunately lost lovely New York bureau chief there. I'm not sure what happened. I think she was about to say something against the national good. Maybe the CIA kind of jumped in on the call there and chopped her off in her prime. So I think we'll go to a song now. That always comes to the rescue in these moments. And we have a song lined up. This is Will Do by TV on the Radio.
It might be impractical to seek out a new romance. We won't know the actual if we never did. Any trouble do, my love. The choices, words will take me back to you.
Oh. And that was a song from New York-based TV on the Radio.
And unfortunately, we're not going to go back to Aisha Spears. To hell with it. We lost the ISDN line, and so we've given up on her. But if you want to know more about Petraeus, you can join us in a couple of hours, because tonight on the Monocle Daily, we're going to be looking at the story of the man and a little bit about the kind of how you write biographies of these figures and what was really going on. So lots more there. So please join us. But that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next, the news. And after that, it's this week's episode of The Culture with Robert Bound. Today, he's going to be heading to Russia to meet a woman who's attempting to reinvigorate one of Siberia's coldest cities, and also add a bit of art and literature to it as well. We're also going to hear a Midori House session from the Canadian sisters, Tegan and Sarah. That's all from us. It's time to say goodbye.